great to have you because you've been a stalwart audience member for so many things, and I've been enjoying reading various writings of yours, and so it's good to put you on the spot. And so I'll let Jason say whatever he wants to say about his work, other than it's really good. And then, so you'll read for a while, and then Mark and Faye and Denman will come back. And let's see, what else can I say? If you didn't contribute, $20 suggested donation. There's a red can on the counter, so support the arts in America, because that might be all any of us ever see the way things are going. I better not go there. That's it. Okay, so Jason. Right.
Well, so. This is a this is from a book I'm almost done with called Listenings, and I first started thinking about it actually at a house concert here in December of the year before last. So and basically just started reflecting on, for one thing, the many concerts I've been to in, you know, in all the years, and then that just widened to thinking of all the listening I've done throughout my life, which has been, seems like everything has been listening, is what I concluded. So I got to the point where I figured I have to write a book with this sense, since it just kept growing. So they're short texts. I've written about 100. I think there's a few more that I want to write, but I don't quite know where the end is yet. And about half of them relate to music and all kinds of things. So, first one, and they don't have titles or anything, but they have certain themes which I sometimes stay on and sometimes go wherever. So, this one is relating to the language. One of those words that bear an implicit assumption of a second word, usually a preposition. Listening to. What? That is the most immediate dynamic adhering to the single word. Listening to something. Fine, we could be at it for years just on that, drawing it out. But we might also consider other prepositions to start with. What do they do? What nuances do they awaken? Listening at, the limits, the speed of, an altitude of. Listening after, dark, making love. Listening into, the deepest corners, your heart. Listening behind, your movements, walls. Listening from, a quiet place, fear, up a tree. Listening past, the graves, the noise. Listening on, a whim, a mountainside, your Aunt Betty's rooftop. Listening through, the lousy melody, the stuttering, the water. Listening under, the house, your breath. Most often there is still the sense of two lurking. But what about just listening without any prepositions? Is listening lonely? Does listening not know what to do by itself? Listening is a form of attention. It happens both voluntarily and involuntarily. She was not trying to listen in on our conversation. Do we not listen frequently enough without our full attention? And so where does the rest of it go, hmm? Our willful attention will likely be marshaled when we listen to something, no matter if it's just a distraction. But there is also a kind of listening that pulls in everything out there, open to the full spatial complexity of a given place and time. Listening indeterminately, yet in appreciation of what is found. Are these modes of listening, these shifts of inner mechanisms and balances, mutually exclusive? Our listening can do it all if we so choose. You can hear the lovely music along with the movements of the crowd and the wind through the trees. No need to be distracted. You are part of the concert. So they're, they tend to be, as I say, thank you. They tend to be, well, roughly 1 to 5 pages. And these are in the middle of all that. Okay. What are we searching for so assiduously? To hunt, dig, excavate, unearth from the vaults. Recorded music is far more complicated than meets the eye. Visually, it's as if nothing, a wafer, a ribbon. But what is embedded there in that nothing can reach astronomical value or promise the most arcane of illuminations upon listening. Or it is just one more record, like a billion others. We don't know, and because of that, we spread out through the record stores and flea markets and library sales, our fingers walking the stacks, ever on the trail of a find. How will we recognize it when we see one? The aim is not simply to add another item to the collection or to snag a few bargains, all very nice, but we're a little beyond that. We, the tribe of discerning listeners, must keep looking. There are always records we don't know about, or we didn't know about, that may or may not be worth having. No need to be a completist. The mental cataloging also has to be fed, as much as the ears. Sometimes it's enough just to read the cover and imagine the rest. Still, I wonder what will jump out at me each time I step into the alternate universe and extreme sport known as the WFMU Record Fair, as I did the other day. What recording will suddenly land in my hands that says, "Do not let it go"? I dodged the vinyl completely, mountains and mazes of vinyl the past several years, though I may take a glance the next time. I don't care about the stamp collecting aspects, the rare pressings and alternate album covers. It's only the music that matters, and some old albums never made it to digital. Instead, I comb through the CD stacks, especially the many $3 bins, while a whole elaborate inner dialogue plays out with each title I linger over. Faint sympathetic tones echo from across 5 decades of listening to recorded music as I whittle down the reasons for keeping all but a few of my selections. It's amazing enough to see what resonances are struck in the mind at the mere sight of a name or a cover, and like a keyboard full of Proust's Madeleines, an internal sampling reflex, my thoughts bounce around an entire lifetime and further. A couple of years ago at the record fair, deep in the $1 stacks, which I normally consider a waste of time, I chanced upon a CD by Kolinda, which turned out to be, as I'd suspected, the Hungarian folk group I heard on record all the way back in 1980, when I was living in that crumbly neighborhood in Lower Montparnasse on the Rue du Texel near Pernety. A neighbor on the ground floor played it for me and let me make a cassette copy, which I still have in my basement. Bernard, the person, committed suicide not long after I moved across town. I could still recall the tonalities of the group's sound, and so for $1, I had a later record of Kolinda some 3.5 decades after first hearing them. Clearly, when we listen to a recording, we are listening to so much more. Something else about the $3 bins at the record fair, a reminder how popular artists live on. I saw live recordings by The Doors and Jimi Hendrix that I'd never seen before, not that I've kept up, probably released in the last decade or two, but nonetheless many years after their deaths. I resisted the urge to feel like I had to buy them. Even in the 60s, half a century ago, an awful lot was recorded, so we never know when a new record may yet come out of someone long gone. Indeed, we like to be surprised by such discoveries, as if to remind us that time may be circular or built on resonances as much as linear, and that we might still hope to hear from the lost. Whether in used record palaces like Amoeba in California or the WFMU Record Fair, I think that is what drives our perennial search. The thought, for me, of a previously unknown recording of Chris McGregor surfacing, or further back, Herbie Nichols sessions. Records that don't exist, that might have at a moment unaccounted for, that suddenly materialize almost because we went looking for them.
So, gotta get some water.
This is a basically non-music, but not entirely. Along a dirt road in the woods, over a series of ruts left by the tire tracks through the mud, the ice that lay across them had a frosty cast, opaque as clouds, unlike the shiny sheets of ice on the ground nearby. I thought, it's below freezing outside, why not try? One careful step, then another triumphant, until I was marching slowly upon every rut, savoring the dull yet resonant sound of the cracking and crumbling. Half an inch thick or more, that skin of ice covered no water underneath, which likely had drained into the cold dirt. So back and forth I stepped, gleeful at the celebration of all that breaking. And what if someone hears my happy mayhem, I wondered briefly in passing. Who cares if they think I'm daft or acting like a child? But would I, should I, share it with another, let them have a chance? Too late, not enough to go around. I was having too much fun to leave any unsmashed. The brittle seasons bring their own abundant gifts for those of us inclined to partake of them. Among my earliest sensations, I think, was an inexplicable joy at the clattering, crackling, loud dissolution of autumn leaves. Wonderful to go leaping into a cool, cacophonous pile of them. Better still to go stomping where they gather, kicking the leaves against each other, sending them flying, never to scatter quietly, with each pass the resonant breakage a little finer underfoot. In the Jardin des Plantes in Paris, where I lived nearby in the early 80s, I would often go strolling up and down the long alleys of plane trees, my gaze aloft at the high canopy they formed, the birds gliding all the way just underneath, as I aimed deliberately for where the leaves had gathered, to kick up a percussive snap and clatter just by walking through them. If someone ever invites me to their castle and wonders at my absence in the hour of the feast, there they'll find me up some alley, seeking noisy congress with the fallen leaves. But is it not quite literally the sound of breaking that grants such pleasure? When a glass or window shatters, subtract concern or anger, is not our interest heightened? Can we refrain from turning our head to look at the patterns that result, their fascinating singularity? Disaster movies, mere car wrecks have long captivated audiences, but cut out the sound and the sight is far less disturbing, less real. Cut the image instead, and we see it anyway. And aren't the promises of revolution predicated on breaking, tear down the old institutions so we may build something new? We want to really hear the breaking with its sensual and existential thrill, for it reminds us we're alive, that we're still here, survivors of our complacency. And from that destruction, that sound sprung from nothing, a space is formed where surely something else will come along. Okay. This one is another music one. A question that has occupied me at least for a long time. Years ago, in a number of interviews I did with older writers, I tended to ask them at some point about music. Did they listen much? What were their preferences? How did it count for them? Inevitably, I zeroed in on a question that especially interested me. Did they listen to music while they wrote? Some replied never, or not usually. A few admitted they sometimes did, or remarked how that changed for them over time. Often, then and since, I remained on the lookout for that theme when reading comments from other writers. I thought even to make a survey, culled from my own investigations and beyond, but let it go. Who would be interested in the question but me? Has to do with divided attention, though maybe it's not really divided. It's about doing two things at once, yes, and stories abound where brain surgeons or master chefs or many a painter also have music playing while they work. So why not word work? What makes thought and the articulation of language, the spinning out of verbal material and hammering it into shape like a shield or a road or a river, an activity that could be impeded by music more than any other enterprise would be? Properly speaking, when we listen to music, we shouldn't be doing anything else, unless perhaps we're dancing or simply walking. Nam June Paik, when I interviewed him, defined good music as something you could listen to with your eyes closed. We quickly get into definitions with such matters, distinguishing one kind of music from another and their respective places in our life. Music, if it could be asked, would prefer we surrender to it, knowing that sooner or later we will. And yet, mostly we listen to music in the background or as accompaniment while we do something else, even as company to not be so alone. Our attention, rather than divided, is augmented. Our attention span is stretched, like a bridge that reaches further across the world than we'd imagined. Another way to consider the play of our attention is to realize that it is not just one thing. Our attention is multiple, multivalent and multidirectional, splashing about in the simultaneity of experience. Just as we have five or more senses and peripheral vision and depth and breadth to our hearing, we also exercise a sort of secondary attention, and presumably more. We may not always be conscious of where our attention goes on our behalf, and surely it ventures against our will at times, but we needn't be afraid of where it takes us. Some people manage to train their attention to the point of performing marvels, very well for them. Others are content or merely helpless to let it wander where it can, in the belief that it is naturally domesticated and will come home eventually. But bring music into the picture and all bets are off. seduction, or healing force, its hold on our attention is hardly predictable. In contrast to words and the thought it takes to digest them, music seems relatively easy to consume. Thus, the notion of background music, soundtracks, even furniture music, or as mere goad to the physical. But consume is an odd word in speaking of music. Is music a substance, a food? No question we can feel its effects on our system. So-called difficult music challenges our well-worn comforts, and a hint of the exotic may lift us out of what we thought we knew. In listening to music when I write, I have sometimes thought of it as choosing the mental landscape around me, some element of mood and coloring and energy, which may cover up as well the incidental sounds nearby. At any rate, let's just say I have seldom chosen music that my childhood schoolmates would listen to. But like some older writers I spoke with long ago, I have found I put on music less and less while bouncing words around the caverns of my head. I cannot really say if the music helped or hindered the writing, but probably both. Is it that the nature of my own listening has changed, along with my processes of thought and imagination? Surely all that, and also something to do with aging, the evolving circuitry of my attention, the accumulation of experience, the synapses of memory lost or found, and let's not forget whatever my metabolism is up to. Since I have always approached writing as a form of listening in itself, perhaps the words have gotten louder or more demanding or just more squirrely, leading me on and on before they're even written until I'm lost. Perhaps the music has also wised up as to throttle me while saying, enough with the two-timing already. And maybe that is what those older writers felt as well. So, one more. I think it's out of order. So, okay. Got it. Okay. Okay. Surely there is a sound life of objects and things just beyond us. What may seem silent to our ears might not necessarily be silent in another scale or frame of time. The warping of wood, the stretch and twist and bend of the material long after the branch has fallen or the tree has been cut, we are not likely to hear it. But that slow internal movement of the solid mass, that letting go down to the chemical level, does it not stir the air around it, set sound waves in motion even to a small degree? Would highly sensitive recording equipment geared to the proper duration of that action be able to capture the sound? Or right at the center of the instrument, a piano sounding board, as it begins to crack from heat and dryness, that prolonged sound event can hardly be appreciated in itself, except for the echo it pushes from the strings, perhaps. The workings of organic matter, with their intricate dynamics, might well be considered for a proliferating alphabet of unsuspected sound properties, but what of simpler processes? Yesterday, after washing a small cheap thermos and placing it upside down in the drainer, I noticed what I thought was the faint gurgling static of a radio signal nearby, as if it were about to tune in a message from afar. I couldn't for the life of me figure out where it was coming from, what pipe or appliance or conjunction of household elements might be producing it, as I leaned in to investigate. Then I looked at the thermos, turned it right side up, glanced at the slight bit of water in the bottom. I held it to my ear. Sure enough, there was the source of the sound, though I still saw nothing that explained it. Today, same comedy, the thermos as innocent looking as ever. Try as we might to ignore it, matter keeps speaking to us in the constant wash of cars over a highway. From our stationary vantage point at a distance, what are we hearing? Friction. Less the velocity of engines moving through space, I think, the rubbing of rubber on macadam as the tires roll along resounds across the landscape, a reflection of our unsettlement. All things rub against each other, on other planets too, wherever there are elemental forces, a sun, an atmosphere. Our hands caressing our lover's body, are we listening to that? Probably not. And I wonder, minus the dramatics of moans and whispers, minus the creaking of furniture, just the sounds of skin against skin, would we know? Would we hear it as our skin and our lover's skin and their singular meeting? That's it.
Thank you.